we should be able to do much better as a collective society. I find it quite extraordinary that we have nearly 700 million people without access to energy and over 2 billion people that have access to cooking fuels. What we can do from the global north to the global south is say, let's do it from the beginning as clean as possible. And so you should have access to energy, but where can we accelerate your ability to make the energy transition for the future? We need to accelerate this and not leave it for future generations to solve.
The transition of clean energy will only be possible if we all work towards a common goal. The goal of ensuring everyone everywhere can live a dignified life on a healthy planet powered by sustainable energy. I'm Elizabeth Wangeshi Shege, an energy efficiency and cooling officer based in Kenya with Sustainable Energy for All.
And I'm Anant Vatwa, energy data officer working at SE for All.
Welcome, John Defterios, board member of SE for All, senior fellow for Center of Energy and Materials at World Economic Forum. Welcome to the forum.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
And welcome to Barbados.
Yes, my first board meeting in person for SE for All.
Oh, fantastic. Great location. We'll talk about Barbados later. So on this Let's Talk About Energy podcast, we'd like to hear a little bit more about the scale of the energy challenge through your experiences as well. If we can open up with that, it'd be great.
Sure. Well, number one, I think we should mark what 2024 actually represented. We had two times more money going into renewables than hydrocarbons for the first time ever. So $2 trillion in 2024 compared to $1 trillion going into oil, gas, and coal. So it's beyond the tipping point now. It's the norm in terms of investments, despite what's happening politically around the world, I would say. Number two, the downside of that is if you look at different scenarios, $2 trillion needs to grow to $4.3 trillion on a midway. If you want to get to net zero by 2050, we should be averaging over $5 trillion a year. So phenomenal burst of energy in terms of investment taking place. The base case scenario works for going into renewables, but we need to double it down. And I always like to say that climate change doesn't stop because we have different political winds on the horizon right now around the world, and nor does emissions growth. So we're trying to reduce emissions by 43% by the middle of the next decade, right? That's the long-term challenge, but we haven't tackled that yet. So we need to maintain the momentum that we saw in 2024.
Definitely an opportunity there on the conversation where you've mentioned about climate change waits for no man. There's an African saying that I've just translated on that, and noting that Africa actually has a lot of their challenges from climate change. I think the next question would be, what's your perspective on energy, especially throughout the years with the work you've done all over the world?
Good. Well, I've been in the energy sector as a journalist for 35 years, actually. My first project was in the mid-1980s during the oil bust in 1986 in Texas when oil went down to $6 a barrel and the dislocation that caused. We also went up to the North Slope of Alaska to do a series during that period of time. Would everybody leave Alaska? And the answer is no, because oil prices came back. But it was fascinating to look at that bust and then live through a full generation where you see the fracking revolution, which unearthed a lot of great supplies into the United States. So it solved that energy equation. I feel almost blessed to be able to participate in the energy transition, because I always say it's the challenge of our lifetimes because of climate change, clearly. What sort of climate do we want the next generation? I have children that are 22 and 19. If you fast forward 20 years, what will living look like with this rapid pace of climate change? So the two key things, I think, in the energy space today is getting the transition done so we don't have to adapt to a world that looks very different in 20 years' time. But to make sure we do tackle in the next 10 years at the longest period of time, the target for SDG 7 is to have energy access for all. It's often overlooked. We launched the SDGs in 2016, and we had 1.2 billion people without access to energy. It's been brought down to 700 million, roughly that number. So there's progress being made. But I think as a society, I find it quite extraordinary that we have nearly 700 million people without access to energy and over 2 billion people that have access to cooking fuels. we should be able to do much better as a collective society. So one of the trends over the last 10 years is because of the COVID-19 pandemic, we went through this period of change where we were cocooning, taking care of national priorities. And as a result, we've kind of lost sight of the bigger picture. Climate change doesn't know any boundaries, number one. We want to preserve lifestyles and livability for the next generation and the generations to follow. I think as the baby boomers, which I belong to, we need to accelerate this and not leave it for future generations to solve. So the last decade, I think, has been an absolute game changer in terms of making renewables a viable alternative. It's taking place. We crossed $2 trillion in 2024. We need to at least double it by 2030. The base case for investors is there. What I think the huge challenge is getting the global South connected to energy. And of that 700 million I'm talking about, 590 million are in Africa. And initiatives for SE for All, for example, Mission 300, to get 300 million people connected by 2030, is an extraordinary initiative. And it needs kind of a coalition of the willing, which includes institutional investors and energy companies, to come in and provide that baseline investment to make it happen.
Coming back to your experience with global geopolitics, the fall of Berlin Wall, your meeting or your discussions with the former German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin, what lessons did we learn, or what lessons should the people have right now going into these kind of negotiations, where we say we don't want to be dependent on fossil fuels? We cannot be dependent on fossil fuels moving forward. But when we talk specifically about Global South, many of the countries are still heavily dependent on fossil fuels. We're trying to get them away, but what is the combination of politics that you would think the African leaders, not just political leaders or governments, but the leaders in energy space need to learn from the Global North, just in terms of, how politics is going to work? Should we focus just on myself or, the cocooning that you just spoke about? What's your take on that?
Well, number one, there's a narrative that's emerged over the last 3 or 4 years post-COVID that the global north was dictating or shaping the mandate for African countries one by one. You can't take a magic wand and say, you will do this. So I think what came out of COP28 and the UAE consensus was there's not one size fits all for Africa, and we should look at each African country on its own and look at what resources that it has and what's the journey to the transition. There was a little bit of hypocrisy taking place because a lot of the development banks didn't want to underwrite any new hydrocarbons in Africa. And you could have a very ferocious debate about what is the role of natural gas in the transition. But Africa sits on some very vast reserves of natural gas. So my view, it's almost you use the mobile phone analogy here. They leapfrogged over the hard wires in Africa and went straight to mobile. We should be able to do the same with energy. If you're going to get into natural gas, if I'm a Mozambique or Tanzania or Senegal, right, Mauritania, they have vast resources. What we can do from the global north to the global south is say, let's do it from the beginning as clean as possible, right? And so you should have access to energy. But where can we accelerate your ability to make the energy transition for the future? I think there's also a huge disconnect in Europe in particular, and I'm based in London today and lived there 4 times in the past as a journalist, is that we have to make the connection. Energy access is a right. So having 590 million people in Africa without access to energy doesn't make sense to me whatsoever. But we're going to have climate refugees in the next 10 to 20 years. So they think they're facing migration challenges today because of geopolitical unrest. You ain't seen nothing yet. So we have to be able to, as policymakers, as energy, experts, as institutional investors, look at the totality of the challenge here. It's a climate challenge. It's an energy access challenge. It's a migration challenge. And at the core of this is development. If you give people an opportunity, whether it's using natural gas or renewables, if you give them an opportunity to stay put, they will. And I think policymaking has to use a much broader spectrum when we look at what the challenge is today. It is all about development. I think equity, security, prosperity, which are the buzzwords for SE for All, apply across the board here. We have to think differently about the challenges that are in front of us.
Yeah, I think this fits in perfectly with the challenges that we have, or, you know, the three things that need to go together: energy, development, and climate. So that's what we at SE for All are, you know, striving to do. You can't leave development behind just for the sake of energy access. So all of this needs to go hand in hand.
Well, it's interesting because of that $2 trillion that I was referring to that went into renewables last year, two-thirds of it went to Europe, the United States, and China. 154 countries pulled in 15% of the investment. And some are fast-growing emerging markets with very little risk. So I think when it comes to Africa in particular, we have to break the financial bottleneck. The cost of borrowing is too high. There are no currency protections for some of these countries. And there's a risk of them taking on way too much debt. We should be able to, as a global community, hone in on this challenge to get access to capital, make the base case for business investors to go in, and give them some security as they go in so we can tackle this 590 million in Africa that don't have access to energy. It's not that hard if we focus on the challenge. There's money there.
Yeah.
We have to give some security to those investors.
True.
We have to address governance. Not everybody agrees with me, but I think sometimes environmental, social, and governance can be used as an excuse for institutional investors to not go in to some of the countries of the global south. That should be done to move the needle on environmental policy or on social policy or on governance, right? To clean up the value chain. But I think there's not the risk appetite to go in if they don't have the confidence that they'll get currency coverage, that
security,
the cost
basically
of borrowing will be much lower for this to happen. And it's not that difficult. It may not be seen as a global priority today, but it's the mission of SE for All, and that's the reason I joined the board. We should just focus on what the goal is here, and it's energy access for all in the cleanest way possible.
Thank you for that. And actually mentioning the perceived risk on the finance element and us focusing on that as SE for All to remove that bottleneck that we definitely feel on the ground, especially with the last mile lending in the different countries. Do we know where the energy is? Do we know where the energy resources are? Have we mapped them out? Do you have experience on that?
It's interesting you bring it up because we've discovered through the process of technology where that energy is. How do we do it most economical to bring it to market? And are people willing to take a risk in investing in natural gas, which is a 20 to 25 year horizon, when the International Energy Agency, for example, is projecting a glut of natural gas supplies over the next 10 years. So this is a very tricky window. Renewables are bankable. That's why you saw $2 trillion go into that market in 2024. Getting the modernization of the grids in different countries, cross-border grid connections, it's all great that we add capacity, but how is that capacity distributed? So one of the things I don't think we've done well over the last 40 years is to map our energy supplies, taking in the energy trilemma, security, affordability, and sustainability, right? Having access to energy is critical. We saw this during the COVID-19 pandemic when supply chains were broken. We also saw it because of conflict. So whether it was Russia, Ukraine, or what's happened in the Red Sea and deliveries, it brought energy security to the top of the priority list, right? We should be able to do all, right? Provide security if we map out the energy supplies. And it's not that difficult, again, if you look at it in a regional standpoint. Also, that's why investing in grid connectivity is super important. It's important in Europe as it is in Africa, right? So you can share energy. And we see some very innovative projects through SE for All and others that are saying we need to modernize the grid for Africa. So if you have supplies in one part of Africa, you should be able to share it with, whether it's in East Africa or West Africa, Sub-Sahara Africa or North Africa. And the projects taking place are quite extraordinary. Even the collaboration in the Eastern Mediterranean with the European states of the Mediterranean and the North African states of the Mediterranean, the collaboration now and the grid connectivity is quite extraordinary in the last 5 years alone. So there's a lot of positive things to talk about in the energy space. I think we should never take for granted an over-reliance on any single country's supplies of energy. And we learned that in a very painful way over the last 5 years.
Now, I think since you're talking about innovation, you've had a long career, covered the OPEC. So you know how oil and gas industry works. You've seen all the renewables coming in. What has been the most exciting innovation? What do you think, you know, that could be the thing that changes how we think about energy in the future?
Well, it's fascinating because 10 years ago, we were talking about peak oil supplies, right? And nobody truly believed that you could have innovation in fracking that unleashed not only oil, but particularly natural gas, which was a game changer because of rising demand. The cost of solar power going back 20 years ago was unaffordable. But if you have the right policies in place, for example, in the United States, you have the Inflation Reduction Act. It has nothing to do by name with energy, but the energy transition was built into it. The Green Deal in the European Union has been significant, and the China energy transition policy has been an absolute game changer. So if you have the right policies in place in the major economies of the world, you can move the needle and drive down the cost. And that's what we've seen over the last 10 years in solar, wind. The next stage is battery storage technology, which is coming. There's quite a healthy debate with 28 countries, I think it is, that want to triple nuclear supplies. Kind of we wave this magic wand. It's a very expensive endeavor. So if you have, you know, solar, wind, battery storage costs coming down, and we know the cost per kilowatt hour is in, you know, less than 10 cents, no matter where you are in the world, the options are there now to make this happen, both on-grid and off-grid. So those are the greatest innovations. So, you know, I grew up covering oil and gas from my, you know, mid-20s and onward. And I always was fascinated by it because of the geopolitics of energy and getting supplies and managing risk. But I've been fortunate enough to live through this energy transition revolution where people said solar, wind, battery will never be competitive in less than 10 years. It is competitive. It is. And that's quite a shift in itself.
I think I was doing some presentation and we had the levelized cost of electricity. The most recent one was, I think, 2023. And solar, you know, utility scale solar, it was somewhere around 20 USD per kilowatt hour, something like that. And it was on the extreme left, the lowest end of the scale. And then everything else just started way beyond there. So that was like, we have made it. So now the technology is there. The money is there. The only thing that we need is bringing everybody together, funding the policymakers, the end users, and obviously the private companies to actually make this happen.
It's fascinating. My X handle is JD the Globalist because I'm actually a firm believer in globalization as long as it's managed. I had a chance to cover the final GATT round, the Uruguay round, that led to the World Trade Organization. You know, we lifted over 1 billion people out of poverty in the last, you know, 30 years as a result of the World Trade Organization. Perhaps globalization has been unharnessed, so it needs to be managed. It's the same thing with migration. Getting new populations to come in, you know, fortifies your workforce, but it needs to be managed. You could apply this also to energy, right? People need access to energy, and we also need to address climate. So the energy transition is critical. We can't throw the baby out with the bathwater because there's political winds that change, right? We have to keep our sights on the North Star and where we're trying to go, both in an energy access standpoint, but also security of supplies, which I think is critical. But also we can't lose sight of what we're trying to get accomplished with contending with climate change. I mean, we had the warmest year on record, 1.6 degrees, in 2024.
That was disheartening to see.
With $2 trillion going into renewables. You know, we always kind of wake up late to challenges as a human species. Because, you know, short-term planning in our political cycles seems to be the norm. This requires, you know, monumental steps over the next 10 to 15 years, which many don't believe in, but the reality and the evidence would suggest otherwise.
I'd like to, with this conversation, bring it back to the forum. I think we've traversed globally with your experiences, which is fantastic. So what would be your expectations on the outcomes of this forum?
Well, what I like about SE for All, it looks at the macro challenges today and has the data to support it. But what I think is interesting that it works with a handful of countries on the African continent and a handful of countries in the small island states to show what can work in the energy transition. And the session I'm chairing on Thursday is interesting because it's taking Nigeria and Ghana. So we have the minister speaking about how they map the energy transition with SE for All. We have entrepreneurs that are actually setting up manufacturing facilities on renewables. And then we're having four other guests look at how we can transfer it to other countries on the African continent.
So we've got 5 years to 2030, you know, after all these conversations we have around SDG 7 and the targets set. What are the doubts you have based on the hindsight from what we've discussed and your experiences as well?
Good. Well, my last project for CNN was a series called The Global Energy Challenge. So I went around the world shooting four documentaries and 30 field reports and scores of digital stories. So I could see the challenge, you know, right before my eyes. I think we're unrealistic setting too high of targets, stretch targets for governments to hit. And when we fail to hit them, we lose support by policymakers, but also support of citizens around the world. They're unrealistic targets. Now, just, you know, parse out energy access. When we launched the SDGs in 2016, 1.2 billion people didn't have access to energy. Now it's below 700 million. That's phenomenal progress in less than 10 years, right? But I think we could do better. So my heartfelt view on this is that it should be the number one priority of our lifetimes. Let's set realistic targets to keep 1.5 degrees on target. We crossed 1.6 last year. If we deployed not $2 trillion to the energy transition, but $4 trillion or $5 trillion by 2035 every single year, we will tackle the challenge. Institutional money is out there. We have to make it a bankable asset. We need to lower the barriers for them to go into the global south, particularly Africa. Currency protection, having guarantees from regional development banks and the international institutions to make it happen. Sometimes I think we're tied into election cycles where the winds blow in different directions and it doesn't stay high in the priority list. One thing that COVID-19 did was raise the issue if you know, supply chains were broken, you didn't have access to energy, or if you had conflicts, you know, the price of energy went up. So we need to focus on, you know, access to energy for those who don't have it, security of supply, affordability in that, and then sustainability. How do we do it as cleanly as possible? I call it the global moonshot. It is the challenge of our lifetime. That's the attitude that's needed for institutions like SE for All to accomplish what they've set out. They just need that global momentum behind it because we know how to do it. We just need to deploy it faster and at scale.
Any parting shot that you would like to give to our young listeners? You know, I know we talked about that it's not their onus to solve all of the problems. It is the onus of the generations before to kind of move the needle, start working on everything so that they get lesser problems. Let's put it that way. So what would be your parting shot or I would say word of encouragement for them?
Well, number one, I think we've already tried to shift that burden to the next generations, which I think is a mistake. So from, say, my generation, which is the baby boomers, we have to do all that we can in this window of time. And I mean window to 2030, because you need that momentum to carry us to net zero by 2050. So we have our own responsibility. Number two, I think the next generation is calling out for the leadership today to take action, not to leave or transfer that burden to the next generation. Let's give them a good long runway of success, is what I say. And I'm very confident in the next generation because it's action-oriented. If I can be 100% frank, I mean, I think the baby boomers in particular, if you grew up in an OECD country, we were a little bit spoiled. We were expected to go to university, you know, come out and get a job. You know, in the United States, you have the 401k or a private pension model. We grew very comfortable. We felt like we could turn on a light switch. The electricity worked. We didn't have to worry about the source of that electricity. that has all changed, I think, since COVID-19. So if you look at both COVID-19 and the conflicts that we've seen, I think it's raised energy awareness to the point of knowing where our energy comes from. Is it clean energy? Does it solve problems for the future? And I think the alarm bells have gone off around the world because of global warming at 1.6 degrees in 2024. If you don't think climate change is taking place, you're living in a cave. So we have to, I always say, and you know, we want to support the next generation to take action and swiftly, but this is the challenge of our lifetimes and the lifetimes of future generations. And it's all hands on deck to, you know, provide solutions to them and to society, because the power of technology is extremely good if we deploy it and focus. I say this is the challenge of our lifetime, you know, energy access and climate change. We should make it number one on our priority list, not roving back and forth whether we think it's a priority or not. It has to be in the top three every single year until we solve problems and it becomes the norm.
Thank you very much. That's amazing. It's been so energizing to have this conversation, don't you think?
We wish you energized days ahead.
Yeah, thank you.
During the forum.
It's a pleasure to sit here and focus on energy because it's, you know, if you can't live without it.
Yes, definitely.
This is reality. We just have to do it in a much cleaner fashion, deploy as fast as possible, and focus on the prize, and that's making sure we solve climate change.
Great. Thank you, John, for Let's Talk About Energy podcast.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Please join us for the next episode of Let's Talk About Energy, and please follow us wherever you get podcasts. See you next time.